January the 1st, 1992. From all of us here in London, we wish you a Happy New Year.
Sound the flute. Now it's mute. Birds delight day and night. Nightingale in the day, the lark in sky. Merrily, merrily, merrily to welcome in the year. Little boy full of joy, little girl sweet and small. Cock does crow, so do you. Merry voice, infant noise. Merrily, merrily to welcome in the year. Little lamb, here I am. Come and lick my white neck. Let me pull your soft wool. Let me kiss your soft face. Merrily, merrily, we welcome in the year.
Well, William Blake's natural history wasn't up to much. You don't get too many nightingales in Kent in January. Lambs? Yes, perhaps. Especially at the end of the month. But a January lamb can be seriously at risk. With most breeds, it's usually a matter of a premature birth. But Dorset Horns, and we do have Dorset Horns in Kent in spite of the name, Dorset Horns, for some reason, are much given to lambing early. With a premature lamb, the answer is usually to bring it into the house and feed it from the bottle. That's common sense, not sentiment. But you can find sentiment in farming.
Look at the head and the top line and the shine that they have on the coats. Lovely feminine legs. Nice, sweet face with a star of white and pricked ears. Most intelligent animal there is a cow.
Now, that's a dairy farmer talking. The man down the road with a beef herd has quite another view.
Henry, he's a cabbage on legs, I'm afraid. His intelligence is extremely limited. Oh, rabbits and rodents, far higher intelligence. They are pretty much a vegetable on legs, is a Hereford.
And what do you base this conclusion?
Just by rearing them for the last 30-odd years.
Now, you might think those Yorkshire farmers had a much worse chance with severe weather than we do so much further south here in Kent. Well, you'd be wrong. The Elam Valley, where I've lived for the last 25 years, runs very roughly north to south, from Canterbury to Folkestone, in fact, so that when the wind's in the right quarter, or rather the wrong quarter, there's not much between us and the North Pole except Margate Town Hall, and that's 30 miles away. And where there's a bend in the valley, the north-facing slopes can hold their carpet of snow for weeks, long after everywhere else is clear. And the Kentish lanes don't help much. Being worn down through the soft chalk, they're often sunken between banks more than 12 feet deep. That's a lot of snow. A few years ago, I tried to dig out a way for the horses to their paddock. I gave up after about 30 minutes and 10 feet of progress, and that was in March. Yes, in this valley we know all about snow.
Snowed in? Well, we always got snowed in, didn't we, years ago? We never. No road was open. Well, we had a butcher's van. Remember, Alec, where van was barefoot, it was snowed in there for a week before they got it out. Before they dug it out, they had to dig it out.
Jackson's dug it out, didn't
they?
Yeah. I was one of them.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, we dug it out.
Oh, yeah.
Dug it out by hand in them days.
Yeah.
All the kinks and everyone else has done it bloody easy, and there was Jackson's coming down. Come on, you blokes, dig it right out past them. We're going like hell.
Well, because he was a private contractor.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because he had that big old thorny crop lorry with a snowplow on it as well, didn't he, in them days?
Oh, I remember when it was on bread walking from 6 miles to Stoughton delivering bread. And Dr. Mitchison, who lived at Living, he said, I'll take a bag of bread, boy. And I put about 24 rows in there, and he stuck it on his back and walked up to Stoughton Common with me. That's the only way we used to get round. Oh, I've been back here something like 12 o'clock midnight, and last time I remember we were snowing, the double-decker bus was a bare force right across the road. He got stuck there all night, and we couldn't get back. We had to walk from there.
So you can see that transport in January can be a problem for this village, or, as one writer at the turn of the century would have it, this town.
Standing on a sloping hill among much bigger hills is Elam. The valley, which obtains its name from this old world town, runs between Folkestone and Canterbury. And as we pass through the villages that nestle in their midst, we see on either side great rolling downs. The whole valley is but thinly populated, but as its picturesque scenery becomes known, and the freshness of its air appreciated, we are certain to see Elam and its neighbours go ahead to the tune of the builder's hammer. And there's the pity of it, you will say. The land everywhere is becoming overbuilt.
When I read those words written in 1901 in my garden last summer, I drew in a breath pretty sharply and looked up at the front of the house. Built 1902, it proudly declares. Oh dear. What that writer would have made of the two council estates and the numerous bungalows which have sprung up over the years since his time, I hate to think. He might have been impressed, though, by the strong opposition we rallied 2 years ago against the building of a new development in a beautiful old orchard behind the village's oldest pub. We're reduced to only four pubs nowadays, the youngest, rightly called the New Inn, being a mere stripling of 200 years or so. But heartfelt and loud as our protest was, I'm sorry to say that in the end we lost. So we too await the builder's hammer, or rather his mechanical digger. The funny thing is that, at least according to some local historians, the population today is the same as it was 500 years ago. I know they had larger families in those days, but still. There's no doubt, though, that Elam was once a pretty important place.
Elam was once renowned for its market. Here came peddlers, here came stock dealers. Here were brought hides from the neighbouring homesteads when farmers fed on their own cattle. And it was for this reason that in the olden time the place was called the Leather Market. Although no one can remember the market, the oldest inhabitants do remember when, on each Palm Monday, an extensive business was done at the horse fair, and when the line of horses stretched from one end of the high street to the other.
He'd be a brave man who tethered a line of horses in the high street today. It's the only straight and wide stretch of road for miles in the valley, and motorists take full advantage of the fact, despite the speed limit warnings. Perhaps they're encouraged by the fact that the old blacksmith's shop is now, yes, you guessed, a service station. Those farmers who slaughtered their own cattle and brought the hides to Elam Market would have done so round about this time of year, for keeping cattle through the winter was a difficult business. Thomas Tusser, writing in the 15th century, gave explicit directions.
From Christmas till May be well entered in, some cattle wax faint and look poorly and thin, and chiefly when prime grass at first doth appear, then most is the danger of all the whole year. Take verjuice and heat it, a pint for a cow, bay salt a handful, to rub tongue you know how. That done, with the salt let her drink off the rest. This many times raiseth the feeble up best.
As usual, Thomas Tusser was ahead of his time. Verjuice was the juice of crab apples, and chock-a-block with vitamin C. But his recipe for a sore tail is a bit unusual.
Poor bullock, with brows in and naughtily fed, scarce feedeth, his teeth be so loose in his head. Then slice ye the tail where ye feel it so soft, with soot and with garlic bound to it aloft.
Keeping cattle through the winter's an easier proposition now than in Thomas Tusser's day, but it's still a considerable chore. Keeping any animals outside through the winter is pretty difficult. I came across some I thought would be particularly at risk. I was totally wrong.
Well, the tigers, of course, love the winter and prosper in any snow, because all tigers came originally from Siberia. They are invasive south from Siberia, from the Amur-Ussuri country, North Korea, and the harshest parts of the world. All tigers originally were probably Siberian or Amur tigers. And they, as they colonized further south, they got smaller and changed their color from a pale yellow to the furthest route south they ever reached was Bali, where they were almost orange and rather small, not much more than 50% bigger than a large leopard. So that species, subspecies, is extinct. The Javan tiger is extinct. The Sumatran tiger still survives. But in fact, in a hot country, which they have colonized well, I've mentioned some very hot countries to you, they still do anything to avoid the sun. They'll always go in the shade and spend the days in the penumbra of the forest where there's cover. And they're very happy in the cold.
John Aspinall not only keeps tigers at his zoo parks, he's two of these, one at his home Howlett's at the north end of the valley near Canterbury, and the other at Port Lym to the south, but he breeds them too.
It's better, though, that they do breed in the summer, because we have actually lost some tigers. We bred 400, by the way, here. It's the largest breeding. We bred more tigers, I think, than anyone else in the world. But we have occasionally had frozen litters. I mean, it's two or three times in the last 30 years, they're born on such a cold night. And that's when we started putting heated enclosures in their sleeping dens and breeding dens. And a system where we can turn on the heat if we think they're going to cub down.
Trying to be knowledgeable, I remarked that you probably can't help a tigress with her cubs as you can a mare when she's foaling. Wrong again.
You don't actually assist a tiger to give birth, but you can go in with most of the weekend. The only place in the world where you can go in with the tigers, even when they're when they're cubbing. I mean, I think I was the first to do that in this country anyway, 59. And if a tigress is your friend at a sufficiently deep level, that is, I mean, she won't regard you as a threat to her cubs at all. She'll actually welcome you. Sometimes she'll bring them out to you. But in fact, we don't really disturb them inside their dens when they've just been born, but usually they bring them out to you to show you anyway, if you go in there. They bring them out and say, what do you think of these? And you make the required tiger noise. It's called roosting, which is roughly like this. That's to give her a welcome, and the cubs, and the little cubs will even do a foot-to-foot back, because they can do a mini one. And you establish your relationship then.
We went down to visit a tiger or two, and sure enough, John Aspinall was greeted warmly.
See, they're fairly pale.
I was a bit pale myself at the thought Mr. Aspinall might ask me to go into the enclosure with the tigers, but he didn't. There are other animals who, even more surprisingly than the tiger, actually enjoy the cold.
One thinks of hippopotamus as an animal of the really swampy, steaming tropical rivers. It's been proved at Longleat, we don't keep hippopotamuses ourselves, that they'll break the ice and stay under the ice for hours. In fact, one or two have been lost under the ice, under 9 inches of ice, you know, and they can't get out. They've had a couple, I think one anyway, drowned there. And they'll stay in the ice all day. And the only reason they couldn't survive when the ice age came was not the cold. They're very well equipped against the cold. They've got layers of blubber like a whale. It's the fact that there was nothing to eat for long months, and they, of course, need vast amounts of grass and herbs to eat. And, of course, there was nothing for them to eat in the winter, so that's what knocked them off. And it's the same with my black rhinos. I've got films of them playing in a foot of snow, playing with each other and throwing it up and run around all day in it.
Well, I have to say, sooner them than me. I'll leave the rhinos in January and wait and see what February has to offer.